From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Hey, I hope you're all ready to celebrate St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. I am. Maybe that's just because I'm an Irish guy with an O apostrophe in my last name, but I encourage you to celebrate the great feast day of this saint tomorrow. And of course, most people don't need an encouragement to celebrate with green beer or otherwise. But it brings up the question for a lot of people of what do we really know about the great saint, St. Patrick? Well, we'll try to fill you in on the entirety of his life or as much as we can do in a short interview by interviewing Mike Aquilina. He's the author of a brand new book called St. Patrick and His World. It's available from Scepter Publishers. And later in the show, we're going to be taking a look at the way the Catholic Church investigates claims of Marian apparitions. We'll be talking with Kevin Simons, author of Refractions of Light. There's a brand new statement that came out on March 6th about some alleged Marian apparitions happening in Trevignano in Italy. And we're going to use that opportunity to talk to Kevin about the way the Catholic Church goes forward to investigate such occurrences. Check out my series, They Might Be Saints, which airs every week on Wednesdays. This coming Wednesday, March 20th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, we'll be looking at the life of Father Augustus Tolton. I'll be examining the sainthood cause of the first black priest in American history, Venerable Augustus Tolton, who overcame tremendous challenges both inside and outside of the Catholic Church. So check that one out next Wednesday. And also explore with the Miracle Hunter. I'm really excited for this brand new episode that's coming out about Mont Saint-Michel. That'll be airing next Saturday, March 23rd at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. We look at the miraculous origins of one of the most iconic oratories, where visions of the Archangel Michael inspire the construction of Mont Saint-Michel by Saint Albert. And I believe that they just celebrated the 1,000th anniversary of the construction of Mont Saint-Michel, so it's quite a timely episode. Later in the program, we're going to be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project. For today, we've got the Vladimir Mother of God at Volokomask in Russia. 1572 is the year, and the might-be saint of the day is Blessed John Sordi, who lived from 1125 to 1240, and of course, he's Italian. The question of the week is an interesting one. Is it true that DNA cannot be extracted from Eucharistic miracles? I'll try to answer that one later. And the miracle of the day, on March 16, 1864, the miraculous healing of Ignatius Strecker through the intercession of St. Peter Claver, San Pedro Claver of Colombia. We'll tell you about perhaps the very first Vatican-approved miracle in the history of the United States. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And when it comes to various faith traditions, all of them, you might say, it seems to be that there is a universal belief in angels. There's a brand new study, a global study, about the majority of people worldwide believe in angels, and up as high as 36% had angelic encounters. That's what this study finds looking at angels. And this is considered to be the first global study to reveal people's belief in angels, in addition to the types of angelic experiences. So a global study has revealed people's belief in the existence of angels, as well as the types of angelic encounters amongst believers. It included 800 participants from countries such as the United States, the UK, South Africa, and India, and found that 75 of its respondents reported a belief in angels. In addition, research showed that 36% of those who believe in angels also claim their own experiences with these celestial beings, indicating the angelic occurrences are common. So the global study revealed 75 of its respondents believe in angels, 36% claim to have experiences. So here are a couple of the answers that people gave. So 15.5% claimed having vivid or recurring dreams that felt different than regular dreams. 12% experienced a strong sense of change of action or direction. 12% heard one's names called when no one was around. 10% heard smelled scents that weren't physically there, such as flowers or perfume. 10% seeing repeated number patterns or sequences. And there are various other categories that people responded to in a positive way. Perhaps we might read those and say those don't pertain necessarily to angels. They could be anything else. But that's what the study showed. And this quote, "This study marks the first research conducted on people's encounters with angels, including data on participants' beliefs, experiences, and perception of these celestial beings," said Dr. Scott Guerin. "And the findings shed light on the nature of angelic encounters, provide a deeper understanding of this intriguing phenomena, and emphasize the need for further research." So you can check that one out. I link to it on the Miracle Hunter page on Facebook. You can read more about this new study on angels. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give it a prize, the Miracle Hunter image of the faces of Mary. So last week we asked the question, which city in France experienced a vision of St. Joseph in the year 1660? And the answer is Cotignac. One of the one of the approved appearances of St. Joseph occurred there in France on June 7th in 1660. And writing in with the correct answer, the fastest was Elamir Gattas from Tallahassee, Florida. Thanks, Elamir, for your response to that question. We'll be sending you out the prize, the image of the faces of Mary. Now this week, of course, we're talking about St. Patrick. We're looking forward to talking to author Mike Aquilina in just a little bit. But the question today will be appropriately about St. Patrick. So the question is, according to Irish legend, St. Patrick's name changed from Patricius after becoming a priest. What was his name at birth? Again, we're looking for the birth name of St. Patrick. If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com. And maybe you'll be the one with the fastest answer. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page of my website, miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with author Mike Aquilina about St. Patrick and His World, a new book from Scepter Publishers. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who know me, and even people who don't know me, they see my last name, the O apostrophe in my last name, and they know this is an Irish guy. And of course, as such, I have a devotion to St. Patrick. And probably 2 years ago, I went with my film crew to Ireland and England, and we traveled all over the Emerald Isle, going to places like Lough Derg and Croagh-Patrick and all the Irish places related to St. Patrick all over that beautiful country, all in an effort to produce a new television program for EWTN coming out next year called Miracles of St. Patrick. So he's always someone I'm excited to talk about and to think about, that great converter of an entire nation, you might say. And so we're excited today to speak with Mike Aquilina. You all know him. He's the prodigious author of numerous Catholic books, and he's got a new one that's out just in time for St. Patrick's Day. It is called St. Patrick and His World from Scepter Publishers. Welcome back to the program, Mike Aquilina.
Thanks for having me back, Michael. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always great to chat with you. And St. Patrick is, if for no other reason than I'm an Irish guy, I love St. Patrick, and his big feast day is coming right up to celebrate. And so you've got a new book, it's St. Patrick and His World. I know you're the author of many, many Catholic books. What got your attention on St. Patrick for this one?
Well, I had COVID a few years back when COVID was something new, and so I was confined to the attic of our house for a little while. And one of the things that I read was something that came in email for me, and it was the doctoral dissertation of a man named Billy Swan, Father Billy Swan, an Irish priest, and he had done his doctoral dissertation on Patrick, and I found it enthralling. You know, he was arguing in his dissertation that Patrick should be recognized as one of the great spiritual masters of the Christian tradition, that he should be recognized as one of the fathers of the church. And by the end of the book, I was a believer. I was persuaded, and I wanted to know more about Patrick. So that drove me into the literature on St. Patrick, the historical literature, about Patrick's ministry and about his personality and about the texts that we have that are attributed to Patrick and what historians say about them. You know, Patrick is kind of like St. Joseph in that, you know, St. Joseph doesn't say anything in the sacred scriptures, so we have to learn about his world in order to understand his actions, and that's how we get to know St. Joseph. Well, Patrick's similar to that. There are only two writings that are universally accepted as authentic writings of Patrick, and they're not long writings. So in order to understand those writings better, we have to understand Patrick's world, and that's what I tried to do first in my reading and then in my writing of this book, to make that world more vivid for people so that they can feel that they know Patrick better.
Wonderful. Well, we're so excited about this book, and if there's so many legends and stories that come to us about St. Patrick, and what can we of course, the things like driving the snakes from Ireland or using the shamrock to talk about the Trinity, those are all debated concepts, things that have been attributed to Patrick in hagiography and otherwise. What do we know about the man? Where did he come from?
Well, he came from northwestern England, probably what's now Carlisle, that area. He gives the name of his village, but we have no other evidence of that village in history, so we don't know where it was. It's likely that it was a small place, a small town, because it made no other mark on history. It must have been a coastal city, or a coastal town, because Patrick was kidnapped in a raid by pirates, and they would not venture too far inland. They would stay close to the coast so that they could get away with their loot and their human cargo, because they wanted to kidnap people to sell as slaves. That's what they did to Patrick. So that's where he was from. He was from Roman Britain. And the important thing to know about the time is that the Roman emperor had not long ago withdrawn all of the military presence from that area. And so this was a new development. Okay, the people of the island considered themselves Roman, all right? They were Roman citizens, and they were proud of that. It was something they really held dear, and it was part of their identity. They were Romans. Well, now Rome has withdrawn their protection, and the pirates arise once again, and they're taking advantage of the people in the coastal lands. It must have seemed like the end of the world. It must have seemed apocalyptic to them that suddenly there's this vulnerability after centuries of Roman protection. So it's a difficult time in history, and I think all of those things play into Patrick's drama and probably into his psychology as well.
We're talking today with Mike Aquilina, author of the new book, St. Patrick and His World. And how does he escape? What's the next step for Patrick?
Well, he's kidnapped, and he's taken to Ireland, and he's sold into slavery. Now, a little bit about Patrick before he was kidnapped, all right, because Patrick was kind of a punk. He was a teenager who was kind of rebellious. He didn't like to learn religion. He didn't want to learn religion, even though he came from a family that included clergy generation after generation after generation. It must have been a devout family. Patrick wasn't interested in that, and he made that known. He was kind of in rebellion, and he said he didn't believe in the living God. That's the way he put it, which is a very sad place to be. So he is kidnapped, he's sold into slavery, and he's living out in the elements in Ireland, where there's rain and snow and then heat in the summer, and you're living out there taking care of livestock. Now, Patrick had been part of the aristocracy in his little town. Now, suddenly, he's nobody, and he's suffering, and it's miserable. And he remembers something. He remembers the prayers that his parents taught him. He remembers a little bit from the lessons that he tried to ignore in school. And suddenly he starts to say the prayers. And then he says them hundreds of times per day. And he starts to develop a relationship with the Trinity, God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. This becomes the center of his devotion. He's always invoking the Trinity. So Patrick has this relationship with God, and it leads to some remarkable events, miracles, really. He starts to receive guidance from God. You know, God gives him an affirmation that he's fasting well. And then God lets him know that he's going to be able to escape. And then God tells him, your ship has arrived. You know, it's this wonderful service, you know, of wake-up calls for Patrick. I almost wish that I could get that kind of certain direction in life. But Patrick got it. You know, God had a mission for him. It was an urgent mission, and he wanted him to move along.
Amazing. We're talking today with Mike Aquilina, author of St. Patrick and His World, a brand new book out from Scepter Publishers. And you did mention Patrick worked many miracles, and some of them were miracles of the highest sort, which you might say bringing people back from the dead. Talk a little bit about the things that that Patrick worked when he was doing his ministry.
Well, you know, there's all kinds of literature on Patrick. There are his two writings that are accepted by everyone. No one doubts that he wrote the Confession and the Letter to the Soldiers of Caroticus. And the reason why no one doubts those is because they're written in such bad Latin, right? And they've been preserved that way in bad Latin. Now, if someone were doing a pseudonymous work, kind of a work of fiction in the voice of a saint that tries to preserve the tradition of the saint, they would have written it out in good Latin.
Right.
And if they didn't do it in the first generation, then in the next generation, someone would have refined the prose. Well, Patrick's writings, you know, the two authentic writings, have never had that kind of service. Patrick patches together his writings with quotations from the scriptures in Latin. It's almost as if the only written language he knew was the Bible. And so he could tell his story by stringing phrases together and not caring whether they fit grammatically or not. Patrick's grammar is poor. You know, he repeats himself, he meanders, he follows no chronology, and he never met a distraction he didn't like. So they're difficult to get through. But Patrick does tell some extraordinary stories. I've already talked about the locutions that he experienced. He also, when he was taken away by another group of ne'er-do-wells, you know, and taken on an escape from Ireland, they land somewhere else, and it's not clear where they land. Some people think it was France. Some people think it was Britain. And they land there, and the place is desolate. There's no food there, and they're starving to death. They're afraid they're going to die, and they tell him to pray to his God to make something happen here. And Patrick prays, and suddenly there's this herd of swine that appear, and they eat like kings. They eat like kings. Wonderful things happen to them there. Well, Patrick continues to be guided by locutions through the rest of his life, and it's a remarkable thing. He always seems to get the help he needs from God at the time he needs it.
Wonderful. We've been talking today with Mike Aquilina about St. Patrick and His World, a brand new book about the favorite saint of anyone who's got Irish ancestry, that is St. Patrick. And so we can talk, of course, about the conversion of Ireland. You mentioned this in your book as well. And you also talk about Patrick and his legacy. As we reflect on St. Patrick's Day, which is upon us now, what can we say when we think about what he did for Ireland and his legacy, even in our world today?
Well, Ireland was a tough place to convert, okay? It was ruled by all of these petty kings, right? And they all made war with one another, and they weren't inclined to the kind of behavior that Christians should have. And yet Patrick managed to convert that place, baptizing thousands in short order, and then inspiring so many people from the aristocratic families to commit their lives to celibacy, virginity, and this was a remarkable thing. That first generation that was just so well placed, well formed, and ready to do anything for Jesus because they had that ferocity and that courage from the Irish ruling families. So it's interesting what happened immediately, that Ireland just became a place of monasteries. And then after that, the monks started to go back to Europe and re-Christianize Europe in the places where, with the Dark Ages descending, the church was really falling apart. Now, the Irish kept up the momentum from their conversion for so many centuries that even in the 19th century, they're taking to the United States to flee from persecution over there and from the famine that was plaguing them, and they come here onto our shores, and they really did found so much of the Catholic school system that we have today that became a model for schools the world over and imitated by secular schools and others. So they established the school system, they established the hospital system, and they make it thrive. I think that so much of Christianity in the world is what it is because of the missionary spirit of the Irish, and because of the momentum that they had from the time of their conversion, and that's all because of Patrick. And it's that energy that we feel in those two authentic writings, the Confession and the Letter to the Soldiers of Caroticus.
Wonderful. Well, this has been a fascinating look at St. Patrick, the favorite saint of anybody with an Irish background, myself included. And the name of the book is St. Patrick and His World by Mike Aquilina. Mike, where can we find out more about you, and where can we pick up this book, St. Patrick and His World?
Well, I'm online at fathersofthechurch.com, and you can find my books at the best price at catholicbooksdirect.com, catholicbooksdirect.com.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Mike Aquilina, for joining us ahead of St. Patrick's Day to talk about St. Patrick and His World. Thanks so much for joining us on today's program.
And thanks again for having me, Michael.
God bless. That was Mike Aquilina. Check out his book, St. Patrick and His World, from Scepter Publishers. What a fascinating look at that favorite saint of anybody who's Irish. And we might not even know that much about him, but Mike Aquilina breaks it all down, tells us what we need to know, and talks about his legacy going forward, even in today's world. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Is it true that DNA cannot be extracted from Eucharistic miracles? Stay with us for that answer.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We love getting your questions. People write in from around the world about questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And every time I give a talk around the country, I love the question and answer session that we do after a presentation. I try to answer people's questions. I like that people are thinking about miracles now. I'll do my best to answer them. And so people can write in, or if they invite me to speak at their parish, you can go to the miraclehunter.com webpage and click on the contact tab. Send me a message that way, and maybe I'll be speaking at a parish near you sometime soon. And so the question we got for this week relates to Eucharistic miracles. And Eucharistic miracles is the topic that I speak most frequently about these days because we're in this time of Eucharistic revival, and people find these Eucharistic miracles fascinating and inspiring. For those people who don't know, there have been some very rare occasions throughout Christian history where a Eucharistic host has manifested true flesh and true blood in a scientifically testable way. And this is fascinating. And what's really interesting is when you do the look at the blood type of all these Eucharistic miracle samples, the flesh and blood, it always finds its way to be blood type AB. And so we're talking about the cases in Italy and in France and in Poland and in Argentina and in Mexico. They're all blood type AB. So it's truly amazing. And so one question that I get, and we talk about this blood type AB corresponding to the Shroud of Turin, the blood on that, also blood type AB, but what about DNA? Now, of course, DNA is that fingerprint in blood, you might say, for every person. They have unique DNA, a unique DNA sequence. All 8 billion people, or whatever the number is these days, of people around the world, they all have a unique DNA profile. And so wouldn't it be interesting if they took DNA from these various samples throughout the world, throughout history, and if the case in India matched the case in Italy, matched the case in Argentina, and all the DNA exactly matched, wouldn't the world have to convert at that point? It's an interesting question, I think. And so the question is, why don't they look for DNA? And the answer is they have done DNA testing on these samples, especially the most recent ones happening in Tixla in Mexico or Poland or these other very modern cases. They have looked for DNA. And the strange phenomena is that they have been unable to extract a DNA sequence
do a DNA profile from these modern samples that they've been able to find out other things about. So it is interesting. We don't know the exact reason of that. There are all kinds of theories that say that Jesus had only a human mother and not a human father. So, of course, a full DNA sequence isn't there. Other people would say the sequences have been damaged, and so they're unable to be extracted. In either case, to the surprise of the scientists who attempt to do this, they've never been able to do it. What does that imply? Perhaps it's all meant to be a mystery anyway. God requires a little bit of faith with all types of miracles anyway. So this is a great question coming in today. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day of the week. We all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian feast day or celebration or commemoration of a miracle that lines up exactly to each and every day of the calendar year. So for today, we've got an icon, the Vladimir Mother of God from Volokolamsk in Russia, in the year 1572. And this icon of the Mother of God is a copy of the Vladimir icon of the Moscow Dormition Cathedral. The icon was transferred from Zelenograd to the Dormition Monastery of St. Joseph of Volokomosk in 1572 on March 16th or March 2nd in the old calendar. It is identifiable by the images in the margins of St. Cyprian and St. Gerontius. The name of Cyprian is associated with the first arrival of the ancient Vladimir icon from Constantinople to Moscow in the year 1395 and Gerontius in 1480. The Vladimir icon finally came to Moscow. And the Volokomolsk icon was dedicated atop the gate in the church in the south gates of the monastery of St. Joseph in the year 1588. For more information on this Vladimir icon of the Mother of God from 1572, you can go to the 365 Days with Mary project on the web, on Facebook, or you can download the free app on the Apple App Store, 365 Days with Mary, Marian Calendar. Let's take a look at the miracle of the day. We do this every week now. This is a new thing that we do for 2024. I can't believe it's 2024 already, but this is a new thing we do on the show where for each and every day we find a miracle that happened at some point in Christian history. So on March 16th, 1864, there was the miraculous healing of Ignatius Strecker through the intercession of St. Peter Claver, or San Pedro Claver, of Colombia. Now, according to the notes from the old parish, Strecker came to America from Germany and settled in what was then St. Joseph Parish, staffed by Jesuits. Strecker, who was devoted to his faith and his family, was seriously injured in 1861 when he accidentally struck his chest sharply against a pointed piece of iron at a soap factory where he worked. A tumor-like inflammation began to grow, and he developed symptoms of tuberculosis. A fever set in, his breathing became difficult, and he couldn't even eat, and he was told he had 2 weeks to live. A parish missionary, Father Francis Xavier Weninger, gave a sermon at St. Joseph on St. Peter Claver's intercessory power with God. After the sermon, he blessed the people with a relic of Claver. Strecker's wife went home and begged her husband to ask Claver to intervene with God for a cure of his fatal condition. He had never heard of Peter Claver, but he began to ask for his help. The next day, March 16, 1864, with the blessing of the sick and the relic, as the parish history recounts, with sincere faith and strong confidence, he placed himself in line of the sick. Father Weninger blessed him and allowed him to kiss the relic. A few days after the blessing, Strecker returned to work. The breastbone and ribs healed rapidly, and the tuberculosis disappeared, all within a couple of months. His doctors recognized his cure, and there was never any relapse, and the miracle was authenticated by the Vatican in 1887, and St. Peter Claver was canonized in 1888. And this may be the very first case of a Vatican-approved healing miracle in the history of the United States. And that's today's Miracle of the Day. Each week, we'll be giving you a new Miracle of the Day, so stay tuned for what's coming next. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about my television series, They Might Be Saints, about Americans on the path to sainthood and the search for canonization miracles. And also, there's a book, an EWTN religious catalog of the same title, They Might Be Saints. We always try to keep you up to date about who's coming down the pipeline as far as saints go. And so at the end of January, the Holy Father, Pope Francis, received an audience, his most reverend eminence, Cardinal Semeraro, prefect of the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, and during this audience, the Pope authorized the same dicastery to promulgate a decree about the heroic virtues of the servant of God, Gianfranco Maria Chiti, a professed priest of the Order of Friars Minor Capuchin. He was born in 1921 in Italy and died in Rome in 2004. And this diocesan priest, the founder of the Congregation of the Augustinian Daughters of Help, dedicated his priestly life in a particular way to the benefit of abandoned childhoods. To the attention towards children, he was added for the sick. He dedicated a lot of time to prayer, for which he drew nourishment to do good. He cared about the condition of women in an era in which women were subject to much discrimination. And that's from the description that's found on the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints websites about Venerable Gianfranco Maria Chiti. And with one miracle, he'll be declared a blessed. With a second miracle, he'll be named a saint. Let's also look at the Might Be Saint of the Day. We do this every week where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood, servants of God, venerables, blesseds, before they have all their miracles and are declared a saint by Rome. And so for today's date, we have Blessed John Sordi, who lived from 1125 to 1240 in Italy. And his feast day is today, March 16th. He was born in the year 1125 at Cremona, Italy, as John Sordi. He was a Benedictine monk at the Abbey of St. Lawrence in Cremona. He became abbot in 1155, and he sided with the Pope against Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, and so he was banished from the abbey by the emperor, and he became a hermit near Mantua in Italy. He was the bishop of Mantua in 1174, replacing a bishop who was removed for transgressions of the office. In 1177, his predecessor repented, returned, and requested the return of his see as bishop, and John asked permission to resign and return the mitre to the previous bishop and return to his life as a hermit. And the request was granted, and John transferred to Vicenza in Italy. John was murdered by a man who had embezzled church funds and whom John was reprimanding. As John died, working for the church and correcting a sinner, he is considered a martyr. So he died by murder on March 16, 1183, at Vicenza in Italy. He was beatified by Pope Leo XII on March 30, 1824. With one miracle, Blessed John Sordi will become Saint John Sordi. So something to pray for there. And for people who want to tune into They Might Be Saints, and again, you can get the book They Might Be Saints on EWTNRC.com. If you tune in on Wednesday, March 20th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, you can see the episode about Father Augustus Tolton. I'll be examining the sainthood cause of the first black priest in American history, Venerable Augustus Tolton, who overcame tremendous challenges both inside and outside the Catholic Church. Check that one out next Wednesday, March 30th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Kevin Simons about the new statement from the church about alleged visionary Gisella Cardia from Trevignano in Italy. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Every so many years, or maybe even more, every so often we get a statement coming out from a local bishop when we talk about Marian apparitions. And people know me from my work on my website, miraclehunter.com, where I've documented as many as 2,500 Marian apparitions claimed throughout Christian history. We have a great number of those that are that happened before the investigative process of the church, and then we have those cases where the church has judged to be supernatural. And there are others in the middle where the church says maybe, and more investigation is necessary. But then there are those cases that we receive a full-on condemnation by the local bishop, and the local bishop is the only one who has the authority to make such a decision before Rome might be involved. But we have a case that just came out. We have a new statement coming out on March 6th, issued by a diocese in Rome, talking about this apparition that was claimed in Trevignano in Italy to alleged visionary Gisella Cardia. And this is something that has caught a lot of attention around the world, even leading up to this point. There are many devotees or interested people, perhaps, to this claimed Marian apparition and some of the phenomena that surrounded it. And we want to make a sense of what was recently stated by this local bishop and what's next in this case of an alleged Marian apparition. Well, we're so excited today to talk to a true expert on Marian apparitions and the judgments of the church, and that is Kevin Simons. He's the author of Refractions of Light and several other Catholic books. We welcome back to the program today, Kevin Simons.
Hey. How are you doing today? You're doing all right?
Doing just fine. And this is always interesting to me when I think that when the church releases these statements, I think that it's necessary at times for the church to clarify when there's a visionary making various claims, saying that they're receiving visions of the Mother of God. The church needs to investigate these things and give a statement at times. And I think even before we launch into the Gisella Cardia alleged apparitions, it's probably worth saying, what do you think motivates the Catholic Church to release statements such as the one that came out on March 6th?
It's basically about the faith and good morals, you know, the proper ordering of these. And so if there are disturbances or disputes that arise among the faithful, or even errors of fact or of doctrine that come out that could disturb the faith, the bishops have to respond to that. And that's the general motivations for these sorts of decrees and statements.
And what are there are various types of things that a bishop could give, different formulations to put it in this category of established as supernatural or not established as supernatural or somewhere in between. What are the various statements of the church that could come forth in a statement from a bishop about apparitions?
There are three traditional Latin expressions that the church gives for these matters. The first is Constat de supernaturalitate, which is means it's supernatural in origin. Then there's constat de non supernaturalitate, which means it's not supernatural. And then there's a third category that's a little bit more muddled, but a little less understood. But it's called constat de non constat de supernaturalitate, which means that the supernatural is not established. So some people kind of view it as like a like an in between, like the. It's not a definitive negative judgment, but it means that it's not looking good. They need to have more information before they can make a definitive ruling. So those are the three traditional expressions to use in these matters.
And so the middle category, which some might call a maybe, it's probably a more of a negative-leaning thing than a positive-leaning one based on what you're saying.
Yes, there's only two categories, positive and negative. But in the negative category, both of those expressions, non-constat and constat de non, are both in those. It's a lesser known fact, but yeah, it's still a negative because it doesn't prove a supernatural origin, so it's automatically in the negative, but of a lesser, it's less harsh, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So when we talk about the recent statement that came out on March 6th from the Diocese of Civita Castellana from the Bishop Marco Salvi, talk a little bit about, even before we got into the statement which he needed to release on March 6th. Why did they have to go through this investigation by a group of experts, fervent prayer, attentive discernment? Why did they have to do all this? What was being claimed in this case in Trevignano?
Well, the case involves a woman named Gisella Cardia and her husband. Between the two of them, they were claiming these visions and revelations from the Virgin Mary, as well as even God the Father. And a lot of people were believing them. And she had gotten international fame. She had been translated into English, and things were available here, even within the United States. So the bishop, and I believe that he's a fairly new bishop. I think he hasn't been in the diocese too long, but almost as soon as he became bishop, he took interest in this case, which is his prerogative and as well as his duty as bishop in this case. And so it was like, hey, you know, I'm going to look into this. So the commission had been established, and he looked into it. And on March 6th, he published the 6-page letter in Italian that explained everything, both what the issue was, as well as how they went about their business of conducting the investigations, et cetera. And then specifically then talking into the point about, like, all right, what does the church teach on these matters? How do we decide these things? And then going into the specifics of the case. It's actually a very, very beautiful document. When you, it's probably one of the best ones that I personally have seen. He's very, very clear. He gives you examples, very factual, and he doesn't pull his punches. But it's respectful, but it's just, it's basically a just the facts, ma'am, kind of approach, which is very, very good. I might even dare say I call it a model for other dioceses in the future to follow suit if something like this happens in their diocese.
Wow, that's quite a statement. I know that you've studied these statements from all over the world, from various dioceses throughout Christian history. I know you're quite a scholar of these things, and we're talking today with Kevin Simons, author of Refractions of Light, about this alleged apparition, Gisella Cardia, that was recently given the negative judgment by the local bishop. Now, I think it's important to talk a little bit about the backstory here. I think that this alleged visionary, she and her husband, Gianni, they brought back this image of Our Lady of Peace from Medjugorje in the year 2014, and not to make a statement for or against Medjugorje, but that's the origin of that statue. And according to Gisella Cardia, the image not only wept blood, but also multiplied food. And from that statue, I believe, emanated a statue on the third day of every month, or the third day of each month, as happens on the 25th in Medjugorje. They have a special day of the month where they claim visions of Mary. So this was quite a claim to be made, and a nonprofit organization came up as a result, as you mentioned, with all the donations and all the chapel that was built as a result. So what did the local bishop say related to perhaps the messages related to this statue or that she was claiming to receive?
Well, in the section entitled Motivation of his decree, which is found begins, I should say, on page 2 of the Italian text, he mentions what the church's rules are, and he bases himself upon the 1978 document, Nomine Sacrae Congregationis, about the criteria and things of how the church should investigate claims of apparitions and alleged apparitions and visions and stuff like that. And he lists the positive and negative criteria that are in that document. So things like, you know, manifest errors regarding the facts, meaning things like, you know, just other contradictions. Does somebody say the sky is blue versus, you know, purple versus blue, you know, things like that. Doctrinal errors, you know, Mary is the first, is the fourth person of the Trinity. Is there a search for profit? Is the person ill mentally? Things of that sort. And then after listing the positive and negative criteria, the bishop then goes into the specifics, actually, of the case, some of the things that he wanted to highlight. So he says that, for instance, there is the gaps in the testimony of Gisella Cardia, who suddenly she forgets certain things when she was before the commission, talking to them. But she mentions them in other interviews. So this is a problem in the mind of the bishop because, you know, if she could have been asked certain things, it's kind of like maybe like saying in a way like, oh, I have no recollection of that. But yet here you are on television talking about this. So what's going on here, you know? He also then mentions the internal contradictions in her testimony. And that there are even... that she's not interpreting things, which technically is good for a visionary to do, but apparently in her case, she was contradicting herself, quoting the bishop, because she says she doesn't interpret, but then she proceeds in other parts to interpret things. So that's an internal contradiction. And then he says that there's a contradiction between what she says and what the Bishop Emeritus of the diocese, Romano Rossi, mentions regarding the alleged tearing of a statuette of Our Lady. He denies it, but she says that he was there. And then, the other one is that some things that the Cardias have said conflicts with what other people have said. So these are some points that, the bishop points out in number six of the motivation section of, the document. And indeed, those are troubling, because if you don't have a consistent testimony, you know, we're talking about like major things, not like minor things. Like you don't remember what the time was or something. That's relatively minor, but these are major issues. And then other things that the bishop talks about later on in the document, he mentions with respect to doctrinal error. Mm-hmm. He mentions something that's actually very popular, and I'm glad we get an opportunity to talk about this. The word refuges is not mentioned very specifically, but in the larger apparition world, the concept of refuges has been very popular since roughly about the 1990s onward, where these places that people can go to during the great chastisement or some tribulation, and the angels will come and shield everybody and protect them from all these terrible things going on. Well, apparently, according to the bishop, there's some element of this refuge tradition, I guess you can say, in Ardia's alleged revelations. And he quotes something specifically from God the Father that is in from dated March 10th of 2022, and saying that it's a problematic because it's bizarre. He actually uses the word, it says that it's, despite this clarification, the fact that the eschatological salvation of even a portion of humanity requires going to a specific place and being made invisible by angels so as not to be attacked by demons represents not only something bizarre, but also a vision that goes against the soteriological doctrine of the Catholic Church, for which salvation is given in faith in Jesus, lived in the Church, and made active in charity. Hmm. So it's amazing. We actually have a bishop on record now talking very direct, calling it bizarre, this refuges language. And it's really kind of amazing, you know, when you think about it. And actually, now that I'm looking closely at the Italian of text from Perpetrator God the Father, forgive my pronunciation, might have it wrong, but refugio is actually used. Anche il vostro rifugio sarà pronto per quel periodo. Forgive my pronunciation. Yeah, there it is right there, refuge. So it's right there even in the Italian. So,
fascinating. Yeah. We're talking today with Kevin Simons, author of Refractions of Light, about the new church statement coming out on March 6th on Gisella Cardia, the alleged visionary of Trevignano. And so you mentioned that they point out different theological or doctrinal errors attributed to these apparitions, which, of course, when that happens, it does get this judgment of constate non supernaturalitate, that is the definitely not judgment of the church. And when a local bishop gives that definitive negative judgment, there are oftentimes some sort of restrictions that are placed on the visionary, those who are followers of the apparition, perhaps priests who go to that place to celebrate Mass. What were some of the things that were imposed on Cardia and her husband as a result of this decree?
At the end of page 5, going into early page 6, there are five specific things that he mentions, that the bishop mentions. Not only does he specifically state that it's not supernatural, he imposes a ban on priests from celebrating the sacraments or leading acts of popular piety that are in such a way as to connect the alleged revelations with these public, private, ecclesiastical places there, as the thing says. And also, priests can't go to the place where these alleged apparitions were allegedly taking place. Then he also imposes upon the Cardias, on everybody involved, as well as various capacities, to respect and adhere to the decisions of the diocesan bishop, as well as willingness to undertake a process of purification and discernment that promotes and maintains ecclesial unity. He also says that the title Madonna di Trevignano has no ecclesial value and cannot be used as if it had one, even in a civil context. And then he also warns the faithful about the disciplinary and spiritual obligation deriving from the ecclesial pronouncement, meaning his decree, that they have to abstain from organizing and or participating in private or public meetings that take as a presumption that these claims are allegedly are supernatural, and that, you know, no putting pressure on the bishop to decide to modify this decision or the events themselves. Then he gives a kind of a general exhortation for everybody that the Word of God and the liturgy of the Church are real and true places of daily meeting with our Lord and our Lady as a sign of consolation and sure hope. Like I said, it's a very, very beautiful document. Hits on all the things that he needs to hit on, but those are the things that he specifically has decreed in the document.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Kevin Simons, author of Refractions of Light, for talking to us about this alleged apparition that's been given the negative judgment by the Catholic Church. We're talking about the one from Gisella Cardia, the alleged visionary of Travignano. We appreciate you breaking it down in great detail. And I recommend to people checking out your book, Refractions of Light, for people who want to know how the Church moves and works when it relates to alleged apparitions and the investigation thereof. I think this is one of the great books that are out there. And I know on your website, kevinsimons.com, people can go to find out more about your various reflections on some of the things that have been alleged in the Church statements. And I know you have a new book coming out as well, the second edition of your book on Fatima. We're all looking forward to that, and we'll have you back on the program to talk about that one when that one becomes available. But we're so grateful to you, Kevin, for joining us on this program. Thanks so much for being with us on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
God bless. That was Kevin Simons, the author of Refractions of Light, and breaking down that new statement that just came out about Gisella Cardia, that alleged visionary of Trevignano in Italy. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio and check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mike Aquilina, author of St. Patrick and His World, and also Kevin Simons for breaking down the new statement about Gisella Cardia. Check out my new episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter on Mount St. Michel. That's this Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Explore the miraculous origins of one of the world's most iconic oratories, where visions of the Archangel Michael inspired the construction of Mount St. Michel by St. Albert. And we'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.